Chapter 9. Inspiration and the Guru. The Need for Inspiration. Before we can board the lightning vehicle of Tantra, we have to understand why it is both necessary and possible to abandon our ordinary, limited view of ourselves and generate in its place the enlightened self-identity of a fully evolved being. We have to realize that our low opinion of ourselves, which keeps us trapped in the cycle of perpetual dissatisfaction, only arises because we are ignorant of our basic, essentially pure nature. By generating the prerequisite renunciation, bodhicitta and wisdom, and by delving into the clear nature of our mind, we create the space in which true self-transformation can take place. Yet, it is not enough merely to know why such self-transformation is necessary and possible. We must also generate the strength and confidence that will enable us to follow this radical approach to fulfillment. In other words, we need to be inspired. We have to know that the attainment of enlightenment, completion, Buddhahood, totality, or whatever we want to call it, is not only a theoretical possibility, but something that people like us can and do actually achieve. In the Buddhist tantric tradition, the source of this inspiration is the guru, or lama in Tibetan, our teacher and spiritual guide, and the root of the tantric path is unifying oneself with this source of inspiration through the practice of guru yoga. At the moment, we are temporarily incapable of dealing effectively with the problems created by our egotistical mind. To help solve this problem, Shakyamuni Buddha taught methods for breaking out of our ego prison and identifying ourselves with the enlightened beings of the past, present, and future. Such enlightened beings have achieved a state in which there is no separation or distinction between high and low. There is only the complete equality of the enlightened experience. The practice of Guru Yoga prepares us to enter this unified experience of complete fulfillment. Through seeing ourselves as one with our spiritual guide, we banish the self-pitying thought, "The Buddhas are so exalted, and I am nothing in comparison." Instead, we learn to identify our innermost mind with that of our guru, who is seen as inseparable from everyone who has already achieved complete awakening. It is through the practice of guru yoga that our limited wisdom grows to completeness. The guru's energy of great compassion, great love, great wisdom, and great skill take seed in us so that we ourselves come to embody these limitlessly beneficial qualities. We ourselves become the guru and, as such, can give immeasurable and inexhaustible help to all beings. If we do not generate the qualities of a true guru within us, how can we provide ultimate benefit for anyone else? We cannot even help ourselves properly. The Internal and External Guru. The tantric texts often mention that all realizations come from the guru. This is true, but we have to understand that guru has two different levels of meaning. The relative objective guru is the teacher who, by communicating with us in different ways, shows us how to act so that we can discover our own totality. But on a deeper, more subjective level, our guru is none other than our own inner wisdom, our own fundamental clarity of mind. Look at the different ways in which people respond to the same spiritual teachings by the same teacher. One person may not even intellectually understand the concepts contained in the teaching. Another may be able to understand them, but be unable to penetrate their inner meaning. And there are those who can reach beyond the mere words and concepts and experience total unification with the teacher's wisdom and compassion. These reactions are all due to the various individuals having achieved different levels of intellectual and spiritual evolution. The more in touch they are with their own internal guru, the more profound their understanding of the teachings will be. Practically speaking, there is only so much the relative external guru can do for us. He or she cannot guarantee that we gain insight and realizations. But our inner guru, our own clear wisdom, can accomplish everything. The practice of guru yoga, therefore, is primarily a method for learning how to listen to this inner guru. Ordinarily, even though we do possess this inner voice of wisdom, we do not listen to it. We do not even hear it. We are too busy listening to the garbage conversation of our gross dualistic minds. We are so accustomed to this that even when wisdom does arise, as an intuitive insight, we often reject it. By practicing guru yoga, we are able progressively to cut through our superficial ways of relating to the world and make contact with the innate wisdom at the heart of our being. When we have done this, we can communicate deeply with the outer guru as well. But as long as we are out of touch with our inner guru, no matter how profound the teachings of the outer guru may be, we will never be able to integrate them. But we should not interpret this to mean that the external relative guru is unimportant. This is not true. He or she is vitally important, although it is true that the tantric teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha have been in existence for 2,500 years. Do they exist for us if we have not yet met a qualified tantric master? Are they real for us or not? Despite the extensive explanations of such realized adepts as Naropa, Marpa, and Tsongkhapa, can we say that Tantra is a reality for us before someone has introduced it to us? Of course not. And the same is true for the teachings of Sutra as well. The fact that Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths a long time ago does not make them true for us. They only become part of our reality once we have realized them. And this depends upon having met a guru who can show us their truth clearly in a way we can understand. If we do not have the living example and inspiration of the external guru, our inner wisdom will remain weak and undeveloped. The spiritual guide and model. For the teachings of enlightened beings to reach us and for their insights to make an impression on our mind, there should be an unbroken lineage of successive gurus and disciples carrying these living insights down to the present day. As a member of this lineage, the spiritual guide who makes the Four Noble Truths come alive for you does so through his or her inspiration or blessings. Familiar with your character and aptitudes, such a guide can make these noble truths so clear for you that your mind itself becomes the path of realization. This is what is meant by inspiration or blessing, just this. And the practice of guru yoga or guru devotion is nothing more than opening ourselves to this inspiration. Furthermore, we need an experienced guide to show us exactly how to put the teachings we receive into practice. We will not get anywhere if we try to learn from a book, hoping to figure things out by ourselves. The information may all be there, but nearly all tantric texts are cryptic, revealing their meaning only when studied together with the explanations of a skilled practitioner. And it is not easy to know just how to go about implementing this information. We need someone to show us, to give us a practical demonstration. This person is the guru. Such an experienced guide is crucial when it comes to following Tantra, because Tantra is a very technical, internally technical, system of development. We have to be shown how everything fits together until we actually feel it for ourselves. Without the proper guidance, we would be as confused as someone who, instead of getting a Rolls Royce, gets only a pile of unassembled parts and an instruction book. Unless the person were already a highly skilled mechanic, he or she would be completely lost. The main reason that religion in both the East and the West has degenerated so much nowadays is the rarity of meeting good spiritual examples. If people never meet highly realized beings, they have no way of knowing the limitless possibilities of their own human consciousness. It is not enough that there are texts recording the deeds and accomplishments of past masters. By themselves, such stories cannot inspire us very much. In fact, they may only increase our feeling of remoteness. Buddha and Jesus lived such a long time ago, we may think, and their purity belongs to another age. It is impossible for someone like myself living in this degenerate 21st century to attain anything resembling their level of purity. Or we may reject these accounts of past masters completely, dismissing them as fairy tales, fit only for gullible children. The only way we can lay to rest these feelings of doubt, incapability, and cynicism is by coming to face with someone who has cultivated his or her highest potential. Only then do we have an example of purity and spiritual evolution we can actually see and relate to ourselves. Thus, the outer guru is of utmost importance. We need the example of someone who, while human like ourselves, has developed beyond the bounds of what we presently think possible. When we see someone who has reached beyond selfishness, who has transcended the petty concerns of this world while still living in the world, who speaks and acts from intuitive wisdom, and who is truly dedicated to the welfare of others, then we can have faith and conviction that these attainments are possible for ourselves as well. Otherwise, if our only models are those of greed and aggression, our vision of what we are and what we can become will be sadly limited. A good model is important not only for those interested in following a spiritual path. The most urgent need in the world today is for peace and harmony, and we all feel this need, whether we call ourselves religious or not. But peace cannot be brought about through mere words, and it certainly will not come about through force. Instead, we need the example of those who have made peace and harmony the center of their lives. It is only the example of such people, living lives of strength and purity, that will convince a disillusioned world that peace, internal and external, is truly possible here and now. Transmission through empowerment. For us to progress along the tantric path to complete self-fulfillment, there must be a meeting of the inner and outer gurus. Our own enlightened potential must be energized and inspired by contact with someone who has already developed this potential to the full. Each tantric sadhana, or method of accomplishment, focuses on a meditational deity who embodies a particular aspect of the fully evolved enlightened mind. And just as the ordinary egocentric mind creates its own limited environment, the fully realized mind of the deity creates its own transformed environment within which it functions to benefit others. This combination of deity and transformed surroundings is known as a mandala. And if we wish to actualize a particular deity within ourselves, we must first be introduced into his or her mandala by a qualified tantric master. Only then will our subsequent practices of self-transformation have the possibility of succeeding. Each tantric deity has its own unbroken lineage of practitioners. To be authentic and reliable, this lineage must have had its source in the fully enlightened experience of a true master. Furthermore, this experience must have been passed down to us through an unbroken succession of adepts, each of whom attained realization by accomplishing the practices of this deity. The strength of Tantra, which has the literal meaning of continuous or continuity, lies in its preservation and transmission of the enlightened experience through a continuous, unbroken lineage of practitioners. Therefore, it is necessary that we establish contact with this vital lineage of transmission if we wish to transform ourselves. And the way this contact is made is through initiation or empowerment. Receiving an empowerment serves to awaken a special type of energy within us. By establishing an intimate communication with the guru, it arouses our potential to travel the tantric path to completion. Initiation is a shared act of meditation. It does not mean that some exotically dressed monk from Tibet is magically going to confer incredible powers on you so that you can control snakes and scorpions. We should not think of initiation in this way. Nor should we be preoccupied with the external aspects of the ceremony, the prayers, chanting, bell ringing, and so forth. What we must understand is that initiation has great inner significance. There is a marvelous story about the highly accomplished 10th century Indian yogi, Tilopa, and his disciple, Naropa, that illustrates the essential nature of a tantric empowerment. Naropa was longing to receive empowerment from Tilopa, and for years requested him repeatedly. But Tilopa, whose behavior was often outrageous and unpredictable, never satisfied these requests. Sometimes he pretended not to hear Naropa. Other times he answered him with apparent nonsense. But still Naropa persisted. One day, After 12 years, during which Tilopa put his disciple through countless frustrating and dangerous situations, the two of them were walking through an arid wilderness when Tilopa suddenly announced, "Now the time for initiation has come. Offer me a mandala." In this context, a mandala is an offering symbolic of the entire universe, and the mandala, traditionally presented to the guru as a request for empowerment, is generally constructed from precious and beautifully arranged objects. But there, in the desert, there was nothing. The only thing that Naropa could do was urinate on the ground and shape a crude mandala from the wet sand. Tilopa accepted this unusual offering and conferred the empowerment by smashing it over his disciple's head. Naropa's mind was so magnetized by this unorthodox initiation that he immediately entered into a deep and blissful state of meditative absorption, samadhi. Much later, when he eventually arose from this profound samadhi, his guru had disappeared. But Naropa had received what he had waited so many years for, an actual transmission of enlightened insight. The point of telling this story is to emphasize that an empowerment is not simply a matter of ritual. Far from it. It is a special kind of communication between guru and disciple, and therefore depends as much upon the disciple's openness and level of development as it does on the guru's realizations. This intimate communication activates our inner nature in such a way that we are empowered to practice uninterruptedly and complete all the attainments along the path to self-fulfillment. Many people, both Eastern and Western, have mistaken ideas about what happens at a tantric empowerment. They think that all they have to do is attend the initiation and the Lama will do the rest. He is giving something special, and as long as I am there, I will receive it. But this is much too passive. True empowerment only occurs when there is active participation by both the disciple and the teacher. It is an act of two consciousnesses sharing the same experience. Only when this happens can it truly be said that empowerment has taken place. Receiving initiation. Receiving an initiation requires more than just bodily participation. Coming to a particular place at a particular time to receive something that someone else will be handing out to you, but active mental participation as well. We need the skill to let go and allow the experience to come, rather than being uptight and obsessive. For, you see, the initiation, including all the meditations that make it up, is a method leading us into an experience of totality. And this totality is a direct antidote to our fragmented, dissatisfied, fanatical, dualistic mind. Through the inner experience of true initiation, all obstacles to the realization of this totality are eliminated. Eliminated not through something that you hear about or study, but through something you actually experience. Why then do we call it an initiation? Because it is the beginning of the experience of meditation, the beginning of somehow activating our concentration, meditation, and penetration into the reality of all things. Through the power of such an initiation, you use the wisdom, skill, and great openness of loving kindness that you already possess. There is an awakening of what already exists. It is very important to recognize that you already have these qualities of wisdom, skill, and compassion. It is a mistake to think that any of us lack them. It is a mistake to think that through empowerment we receive qualities that are totally alien to what already exists deep within us. The Buddhist teachings in general, and the tantric experience in particular, stress that there is a limitless resource of profound wisdom and great loving kindness within each one of us already. What is necessary is that we tap this resource and activate this potential energy for enlightenment. For an initiation to be effective, both guru and disciple must participate in creating the proper atmosphere. The guru is responsible for conducting the empowerment in such a way that it actually touches the disciples' minds and must have the skill and flexibility to mold the initiation to fit the disciples' aptitudes. And the disciples must know how to generate an open, spacious attitude and leave the mind in such a receptive state. If they are too attached to sensory objects, or are too caught up in self-cherishing, or hold on tightly to the self-existent appearance of things, there will be no room for realizations to enter their minds. But if they have trained sufficiently in renunciation, bodhicitta, and the correct view of emptiness, it will not be difficult to unburden their preconceptions and open to the transmission of insight. When the guru and disciple are both properly qualified, the empowerment is pervaded by great blissful wisdom. Instead of remaining a requirement that must be fulfilled before you can enter the tantric path, the empowerment embodies the transcendentally blissful experience of the path itself. Many times in the past, in fact, disciples have attained enlightenment during the very process of initiation. And it is important to remember that for a serious practitioner, an initiation is not something that he or she receives only once. It is customary to receive initiation into a particular tantric practice again and again, each time being better able to receive deeper and deeper levels of experience. So we should not be disappointed if at first our meditation stays only at the level of mere imagination rather than true experience. That is still good enough. Don't think that it's not. Merely to imagine an experience plants seeds in the vast field of your consciousness, and eventually these seeds will ripen into the actual experience itself. This is a natural progression, so you should always remain open and relaxed and be satisfied with whatever happens. The formal practice of Guru Yoga. Once we have received an initiation into the practice of a particular meditational deity, we may begin our daily practice of that deity's sadhana. And one of the first meditations of the sadhana is the practice of Guru Yoga, done in a way similar to the following. Either in front of us or above the crown of our head, we visualize the main meditational deity of the tantra we are practicing, surrounded by the various gurus of its lineage. These lineage gurus are the successive masters who have passed on the teachings and realizations of that particular practice and include everyone from the first master of the lineage through to our own spiritual guide, the guru from whom we received the empowerment. We then request the members of this assembly to bestow their inspiration and blessings upon us, and in response to this request, they merge with one another. Enter us through the crown of our head in the form of light, descend our central channel, see chapter 10, and dissolve into our heart center. As this happens, all ordinary dualistic appearances and conceptions dissolve into the clear space of emptiness. We then meditate upon the feeling that our guru, who in essence is identical with the deity, and our own subtle consciousness have become indistinguishably one. The essence of the guru is wisdom. The perfectly clear and radiant state of mind in which bliss and the realization of emptiness are inseparably unified. Therefore, when we visualize the guru absorbing into our heart, we should feel that an indestructible impression of that wisdom is being made upon our fundamental mind. From this time onward, we should try to recall this inner experience of great bliss and non-dual wisdom repeatedly, no matter what circumstances we may encounter. If we let our mindfulness of this inner experience deteriorate, we will easily fall under the influence of grosser sensory experiences, and the finer bliss of non-dual wisdom will eventually vanish completely. When we visualize our spiritual guide as the meditational deity, we should think especially about his or her great kindness and concern for us. Simply speaking, although the guru deity is not my father, not my mother, not my wife, not my husband, still, he is as concerned about me and my situation as if he were. It is as if he exists solely for my sake, so that I might develop a supremely healthy body and mind. This is how we should relate to the visualized guru deity. By visualizing in this way and thinking of the personal kindness shown to you by your guru, a powerful connection is established. Instead of being some vague, impersonal image, the deity is seen as being inseparable in essence from your own immeasurably kind spiritual guide. In this way, a feeling of incredible closeness develops. Because of this feeling of intimacy, and because the deity is visualized as a radiantly beautiful being of light, inspiration can come to you very quickly. Your visualization magnetically attracts such inspiration, such blessing, and this enables you to develop clear realizations. This, after all, is the entire point of the Guru Yoga practice. The purpose for seeing the Guru in an exalted aspect has nothing to do with benefiting the Guru. A true Guru has no use of such homage, but is solely to speed your own spiritual evolution. Continuous recognition of unity. Seeing the underlying unity of our Guru, the deity, and ourselves is not something we do only during formal meditational practice. We need to practice Guru Yoga, identifying ourselves with the Guru's essential Buddha nature, during every moment of our life. Instead of always thinking about our miserable, dissatisfied mind, we should cultivate the recognition of our fundamental unity with the absolute Guru residing within. Even if our most egotistical mind is arising, instead of adding fuel to it by identifying strongly with this deluded state, we should try to recognize that very mind as the enlightened totality of the Guru Buddha nature, the so-called Dharmakaya experience. See chapter 10. Then suddenly, even this deluded mental energy can be utilized and transformed in such a way that it is digested into great wisdom. This is the outstanding teaching of Tantra. To be able to accomplish such a profound transformation, however, we must practice Guru Yoga continuously. We must become intimately familiar with the essential oneness of the Guru, the deity, and our own innermost nature. In offering to the spiritual master, it is said, "You are the Guru, you are the deity, you are the Dhaka and Dakini, you are the Dharma protector." To interpret this, we can borrow an image from Catholicism, a spiritual tradition based on the existence of one God, one absolute reality. Although God manifests in the three aspects of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, God is essentially one, the principle of totality. Similarly, although Tantra speaks about many different deities, dakas, dakinis, protectors, and so forth, at a certain point, all these apparently different entities are to be seen as a unity, one all-embracing totality. That is the fundamental concern of Tantra. When you develop yourself fully so that your entire inner potential is realized, then you yourself become a deity. You yourself become a Buddha. This is the ultimate aim of Guru Yoga. Touching the heart with inspiration. A common problem for all of us is that our knowledge of so-called spiritual matters is often just in our head, not in our heart. We are proud of how much we have studied and learned about the world's religions, and may even have mastered the vocabulary of their philosophy and meditational practices, yet still we remain basically unsubdued and deluded. We Tibetans often say, "Although butter is used to soften leather, the leather container in which the butter is stored remains stiff and inflexible." Despite the fact that spiritual understanding is meant to soften our concrete, limiting preconceptions and subdue our delusions, it is nevertheless possible to contain a lot of intellectual knowledge about religion while remaining unchanged by it. A dry intellectual approach to spiritual matters leaves our heart untouched and unaffected. What is lacking is the proper inspiration or blessing in our mind. We have to be convinced by some kind of heartfelt, living experience of the existence and effectiveness of a potent spiritual reality, both inside and outside ourselves. Otherwise, our wisdom eye remains closed, and we are incapable of perceiving this profound reality, no matter how much we might have studied. As we have discussed, it is the Guru who provides this necessary inspiration, this link between our consciousness and the actual experience of transcendence. In the behavior of our own Guru, we can see for ourselves the beneficial effects of training the mind in love and wisdom. By thinking of our Guru's lifetime devotion to others and his or her lack of self-cherishing, as well as upon the many other excellent qualities our Guru embodies, and then by dissolving and absorbing the entire lineage of Gurus into our heart, we are enabling these enlightened qualities to take root deep within us. It has been the experience of generations of gurus and disciples that the repeated practice of such visualizations, done in conjunction with the letting go of our concrete conceptions of self, has a profound effect on the mind and can transform dry intellectual knowledge into an organic experience of insight. While engaged in the practices of guru devotion, we should be patient and proceed gradually. It is extremely important not to force ourselves to do what does not feel right out of some misplaced sense of obligation. I am thinking particularly of the practice of seeing the guru as inseparable from the meditational deity. In truth, we cannot see their essential unity until we have developed some measure of the deity's qualities within ourselves. So we should not push. It would be a great shame if our practice of these profound tantric techniques were to degenerate into a custom we felt somehow obligated to follow, the way many churchgoers attend religious services merely because it is something they think society expects them to do. To avoid this, we should allow our practices to develop at their own pace. Eventually, as we grow more and more familiar with the fundamental nature of our own mind, as well as with the good qualities of the guru and the positive effects of meditating upon the deity of light, we will come to appreciate the profundity of these guru yoga practices more and more completely. Breaking the habit of ordinary experiences. The various practices of Tantra are designed to help us overcome not only our vain dependence upon ordinary pleasures, but also our habitual acceptance of ordinary appearances and conceptions. From beginningless time, we have been brainwashed into believing in the ultimate reality of the world shown to us by our five extremely limited and dualistic senses. And now we are trying to break this deeply ingrained habit. This is not easy to do. Our baby wisdom of emptiness is easily overwhelmed by our gross sense consciousnesses. We are like the scientist who knows from investigation and reasoning that a table, for instance, is nothing more than a momentary configuration of ceaseless energy, yet still has great trouble seeing it as anything but a solid, static object. That is why we have to train again and again in those visualization practices that dissolve our false notion of concrete self-existence and strengthen our understanding and experience of non-duality. A major difficulty facing us is that we naturally have a much easier time accepting the reality of our gross sensory experiences than we do believing in the reality of our visualizations. It is common to feel, although I can see myself as made of light, this is just a game that I am playing with my mind. It is not real, but my physical body is real. I can actually touch it and see it in a mirror. What we have to learn is that the experience we have through our imagination and those we have through our senses are actually the same. Both exist only for the particular mind experiencing them. They have no ultimate reality from their own side. A major difference, however, is that our ordinary sensory experiences keep us bound to the circle of continually recurring dissatisfaction and suffering, while our visualizations of conscious bodies of light and practices such as the absorption of the guru introduce us to the very subtle, fundamental level of our being. With this very subtle mind of clear light, we can break out of the prison of our ordinary gross conceptions and experience the unceasing happiness of full enlightenment. If you have not yet tasted the bliss of your fundamental mind and have not seen for yourself how you can achieve a state of penetrative awareness and openness far surpassing what you now feel is possible, naturally, you will be very skeptical. You probably think that the pleasure you feel, say, when you eat your ice cream is real, and that whatever bliss you might experience during meditation is just an illusion. The only way of overcoming such skepticism is by becoming more and more familiar with your own inner reality until eventually it is undeniable. And it is by practicing guru yoga and the other transformative methods that follow from it that familiarity with the deeply blissful character of your own mind is achieved.